accession number 18493, reel 9.
Arnold Lupton, reel 9. About the reception at Southampton, you say that there was some tea and wads and things. Whereabouts was this? At the docks or?
Yes, this was at the docks. Plenty of people waiting there to welcome us and also to try to find out from us if there was likely to be anybody later following us on. Well, we didn't know we were the last boat, but we thought we were just about the last boat anyway. We were the last boat, in fact. And it was quite a full boat. I couldn't say how many it could accommodate, possibly 800, something like that. It was full everywhere. There could be a person. There was a person. Scarcely anybody lying down. There wasn't room to lie down. And we did have some French troops with us also, ones who decided not to keep running through France, but to come over and carry on fighting the Germans, if possible, from England. And we may possibly even have collected a few German spies, but we didn't know that.
Now, how about filtering you when you arrived and getting you away from the docks and to various collecting points? How efficiently was that done?
That was done quite efficiently with the ROs, CROs, I think they called them, routing officers. They'd check up on which battalion you came from, and then they'd be able, they would have records as to where they were, in most cases, as to where that unit was. And they moved, what I remembered, we got moved off quite without a great amount of delay to where the rest of our unit was, which was somewhere on the south coast, more or less Sussex way, and we soon rejoined them, you know, within 24 hours or so.
As quickly as that?
Yes. Yes, I would say we did. Well, let's say we got moving in 24 hours. I can't remember how fast they trains were or anything, but something like that. We weren't hanging about Southampton a long time.
So Southampton, there was a bit of a wait while they worked out where you were to go, and
yes,
then on a train
taken there. Yes, yes. Yeah. With whoever were the senior people in this group, staff sergeants or sergeant major or somebody who was in the group, to take us along there. And some of the units, of course, may have been scattered over a large part of England, but I don't think they were, any of them were there a really long time. I think they tried to clear Southampton docks as quickly as possible.
So you rejoined your regiment quite quickly?
Yes.
Can you remember where you rejoined them?
No, I can only remember it was somewhere in Sussex, not up on the Downs, but it was in a, whether it was near Eastbourne, I don't think it was as far over as that, but I know it was down there, south.
So, what was it like getting back to the unit?
Oh, they were quite pleased to see anybody who'd made it. I did have that once or twice in my service, so it usually was quite a pleasant return. They were sorry to hear of the position we had been in, that we had to leave our vehicles, and so much other stuff, food and so on, which we couldn't be carried. But they were pleased to see us and have us back to add to their numbers.
So what was the feeling like overall? I mean, I'm thinking really of sort of the missing faces, you know, the maybe casualties or just missing or prisoners of war. What was the feeling like?
Well, as this was the first time we'd been in action, a great sense of sadness of the people who had been killed and were missing in one way or the other. And for those, of course, who were in hospital having been injured but were able to get back to England on some other ships. Later on we had to get more used to that, but that was it initially. And the question was then, who would move up and who would come in to make the unit up to strength again?
What was the feeling about how the unit had actually performed? Was there a feeling that the unit had done well but had been let down, or that everything was inevitable? Or, I mean, I'm trying to get a feel for how the men in the unit actually viewed the experience.
Well, we generally, everybody felt that they'd done as well as it was possible to do. We had, in other words, done very well in the circumstances. The circumstances were not a great amount of chaos necessarily, but just under equipment to meet what we had to meet, which went on for a very long time, but still, that was the position. And on the whole, I think everybody from the senior officers downwards felt that we had done a good job as far as we could.
What sort of gaps were there? I mean, you were back with your C squadron, were you?
Yes.
I mean, were there many missing? Or?
We had very difficult to say, you know. It could have been, I don't think there were as many as 20 killed. There were certainly, it was 15 or so, was the best part of it, in various ranks, including one or two officers. And we had quite a few wounded, but most, in fact, I think all of them had got back to England, not back to the unit, but back to England. And some had been wounded too much to come back to us, but others did come back to us a bit later on. And so there were a few places to be refilled amongst officers, or certain officers had to move up and others come in to take their places. There were a few NCOs and of course we needed also some more of the basic troopers and so on to come in. So gradually we did get these replacements in position and taught how good the second tanks were and so on.
Well, obviously you had no equipment. So, I mean, what was the first thing that actually happened to bringing the regiment back to some sort of fighting trim?
I think one tank, first of all, for we got a few tanks in a few days anyway. There were mainly the A9s and 10s and Crusaders at that time. I don't think we got any of the light tanks again, or if we did, they were only provided for the recce part of the squadron, not the sort of fighting part of it, or essential fighting part of it. Yes, we did. It took a few weeks to get all these tanks coming to us. Probably because they wanted to get us off somewhere else. But they did get us re-equipped and trained on using these vehicles and the guns and so on.
It took some weeks. But I mean, what was the unit doing with you to keep you together, keep you busy and so on when you didn't have the tanks? I'm just trying to I'm trying to get a grip on on how they got you back together as a unit.
Well, they gave us training on, as the tanks came in, they gave us training on the driving and the engines and tracks and all the rest of the stuff, guns and things on them. They also gave us training on firing practice, which was now going on all around the coast, I think, of England. And they were able to do that live on tanks at that time. So you didn't need much in the way of places like Lulworth, not as far as we were concerned, to go. You didn't have to go to Lulworth to do your tank firing and all that kind of thing. You actually did it on tanks. And you learnt, well, of course, there was always the old square bashing and all that going on, PT and people on jankers doing various jobs and so on, the peeling the spuds and all that. Yes, there was always plenty of army life. Oh, cricket and, well, it depends on the weather, yes, at that time. Cricket, swimming and that sort of thing to keep you occupied. And we didn't have any spare time, really.
Did you get any leave when you got back?
No. I don't remember any leave when I got back until we got embarkation leave for the next move we were doing. They just kept us occupied all the time, and I don't think leave came into it at all.
Did you, what was your specific job now? I mean, you said everyone was moving around a bit, so what did they do with you in particular?
Well, I went positively onto a tank then, onto A9, maybe an A10. No, it was A9. And had to learn all, you know, make sure you knew all about the various jobs, the driving, maintenance, and gun handling. And it was then that I got sort of specifically put onto gunnery. And there was one thing we found eventually, that the training we got in gunnery, especially from moving tanks, was far away ahead of what the Germans, they didn't have a clue about firing on the move. When you see these pictures of the Germans ploughing through in the Blitzkrieg in France and so on, I don't think they ever knew then about firing from a moving tank. Or if they did, the shots must have been going everywhere. They didn't in the desert either. Not for a long time.
So, you are now on the main armament of an A9.
Yes.
Right. How did this training for firing on the move come about? I mean, what form did it take?
Well, you would be driving along the, I won't say the cliff top, because they couldn't afford to drop tanks off cliffs. But you'd be driving along in the countryside near to the sea, and somebody had set a target up out in the sea of just a thing like a float with a flag on it. And as you were driving along, you fired. I mean, you did some stationary firing, but you also had to see if you could hit the thing while you were driving along. And it was very good practice.
How good were you at firing on the move?
Good enough, I don't know. I could get near enough to the target, or occasionally hit it. In every shoot, I would think. And which did, as I say, do us a lot of good when we moved on later.
And this was standard practice. I mean, even later in the desert, this firing on the move.
Yes. It was normally, in the tanks we had, you more or less had to fire on the move, because the main thing was to get round the side or back of a German group and fire into the backs of their tanks, which weren't so well armoured as the front, and they didn't have a big gun on it either. So, yes, it turned out very useful to be able to do that. And our tanks were sufficiently mobile and speedy for that time to be able to move around quite a bit.
What sort of speed would you be going at when you were firing?
Well, when you were doing this in practice, you'd probably only be going 10 or 15 miles an hour. But when you had to do it in live performance, you might say, could be 20 to 30 miles an hour, depending where you were and what you were doing at that particular time.
What kind of results did you get?
Quite good, really, considering what we were up against.
The reason I'm asking a lot about this firing on the move is even now there's quite a debate about whether it was a complete waste of time and ammunition.
Mm. Well, a large amount of ammunition could have gone anywhere, but we felt that there was usually enough. Did some damage. It might have just knocked their tracks off or something. Or it did get into the engine and set it alight. Or it did get into the back of the turret or something. But we felt there was enough of it. which did good. And at the time, we had to do it, and we didn't have any stabilizers or anything. You had to do it visually. Trouble was, of course, that every now and again you might hit a dirty big rock or something. Your gun would go way up in the air. But as far as possible, yes, we did. We felt that we did quite well.
Right. Was this... This was more than a regimental thing, was it? Or do you happen to know whether everyone else was doing it?
Well, I can only think that everybody else should have been doing it. Whether they were, I don't know. It turned out very well for us, and really it was because in France, so much of the firing was static. Well, they were amongst trees or something like this. It made it a bit awkward because you might get a tree come in just in front when they were going to fire or something. But it was something that they felt when we got to open ground was something that we should do. And I think they must have planned that we were going to get to open ground anyway, even when we were in Sussex.
Right, you re-equipped with largely the same tanks that you had before, A9s, yes. 10s and 13s, and you retrained and brought the unit up to strength. So the next significant thing would be your move to North Africa, is that correct?
Yes, it was.
So can you tell us how that came about? I mean, when was the announcement made? How was it made?
Well, this was another case where the announcement was made that we would be moving abroad again. On this occasion, they did tell us that we were going to, more or less tropical conditions. We were going to a desert area in North Africa, and we would therefore move up towards Liverpool, where we were going to embark, and we would also have again 48 hours leave, which was all we got. So we had the 48 hours leave, and this was an occasion when I took somebody else home to my house. He was a South African who had joined the British Army earlier, I think about 1938, maybe even 1937. Together with another South African, they were both in our C squadron. But I took the one Fred Jansen home with me, which he enjoyed very much. We didn't do anything really except just enjoy the peace and quiet of doing nothing. Maybe went out somewhere locally, I don't know, but certainly not anything strenuous or special. And then we went back to the unit ready to go, and we got I think we got the inoculations at the end of the voyage, not before it. I seem to remember that. When we eventually got to Egypt. But anyway, we went and trained up to Liverpool docks, and got everything ready to load on board. Even in those days, in 1940, August, our great British dockers did their stuff and went on strike because we had live ammunition being loaded on board the ship, and they needed more money for that, of course. I mean, they could do the job if there was more money. They wouldn't do the job if there wasn't any more money. It was as simple as that. So eventually we got loaded up and tanks on board, ammunition, lorries, everything else. And they were on one ship, I just forget which it was called. We, the other people who were not actually travelling with the vehicles, there was only the one man from each tank or vehicle, I think, who went on the ship that contained them. Otherwise, we all travelled on a ship called the Duchess of Bedford, which had been used for conveying people to the the river in Montreal, to St. Lawrence, the Lawrence River, and it was a special flat-bottomed craft to be able to get up there, which meant that, of course, when it got on our seas, it rolled about a fair bit, especially as they had no stabilizers on ships in those days. But the funny thing is that we sailed out in from Liverpool into the Irish Sea. It was either the 19th or 20th of August, and then we came back again to Liverpool because we were taking an awful lot of naval craft with us, including an aircraft carrier who couldn't sail because of the down the Irish Sea at that time, because of the strong winds and heavy sea. So we eventually sailed on 22nd August 1940. I know that date because it's the date of my brother's birthday. And we had had a few bombing do's while we were around in Liverpool, but nothing landed just where we were. Anyway, it was very peaceful to go and sail out on the 22nd, together with a colossal fleet of ships. I think we only had about half a dozen, if that, of merchant navy boats, but there must have been about 20 naval ships, including this aircraft carrier, cruisers, destroyers, all sorts of things, all sailing out. We went and sailed well out into the Atlantic to get away from U-boats, and it wasn't too bad. I never had any trouble, but some people didn't like the sea rolling about a bit. And the funny thing was that when we were on the boat, as I was in the category of a gunner on a tank, where we had 2-pounders as our main armament, I was put on the 6-inch gun crew on the back of this ship, the Duchess of Bedford, which was rather curious. I don't think we did fire it one day, or we had it fired for us one day, just to show that the thing did go off and didn't blow up while it did it. But otherwise, we never needed it, and it was just a big decoration. It was a very nice trip, because with being on this 6-inch gun crew, I had a very lazy time on the rear of the ship with water pouring down the sides of this platform that we were on, underneath which all the ammunition was stored, and that was why the water was pouring down all the time, to keep it cool, because it was so hot going across the equator and other parts in Freetown, and which was the only place we stopped at until we got to Cape Town. Oh, by the way, we had lost some of the naval ships, went off to the Mediterranean, But we still had quite a big force with us. And Cape Town, we stopped absolute maximum of 24 hours. That is, we pulled in. Even the two South Africans were not allowed off the ship. They lived in Cape Town area. We did get off the ship the next morning when they took us all for a march up Adderley Street and so on. It was very fortunate because they pulled up just outside a pub when we got to the far end and had a short break, just enough to sink a pint or so. And then we marched back to the ship, and there were nearly the whole of Cape Town were waiting to take us out and all this. But